Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Welcome to another episode of the Curious Advantage podcast series. This episode is about curiosity and context, and it doesn't fit neatly within our kind of seven C's model because it covers a lot of territory. The Curious Advantage is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and their organizations, and especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, and behaviorism, and it's about curiosity and how these things are making it useful for everyone, stories we can all understand and put into practice. And we're absolutely delighted to have with us today Professor Bill Sherman. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
Professor Bill Sherman is my good friend and a director of the Warburg Institute, but it's sometimes called the home of curiosity. Bill, tell us a little bit more about yourself, but let me say I'm joined by Paul Ashcroft, my fellow author.
Hello.
And let's go at it.
All right. Well, it's really good to talk to you guys. And yes, I am the director of something called the Warburg Institute, W-A-R-B-U-R-G, sometimes called the Warburg Institute because it was created in Germany by a man named A.B. Warburg. I tend, just for pronunciation's sake and for disambiguation, to say Warburg when I refer to the man and Warburg when I refer to the institute. So I hope that's helpful.
We're going to talk a bit about A.B. Warburg because, of course, he's central to this story. But tell us a little bit about yourself and then tell us a little bit about the Institute.
Yeah, so I have an academic background. I started as a Renaissance Studies scholar, and that is actually why I suppose I've ended up as the director of the Warburg, because the Institute is very, very heavily associated with the Renaissance period. I had a long period in America, where I'm from, and then I was a founder of a Renaissance Studies Institute at the University of York in the north of England. But really crucially, I spent about 4 years as director of research and then director of collections at the Victoria and Albert Museum. So I came back to the Warburg, where I had actually studied on and off as a graduate student, via the museum world. So my own background very much combines kind of high-level Renaissance-focused scholarship with much, much broader and much more public-facing activity that I learned and fostered at the V&A.
One of the things I'm fascinated about and curious about with you, Bill, is your PhD on John Dee.
I always seem to have been drawn to people who we sometimes say think outside the box or challenge categories. And that certainly was true of the person who I studied for my doctoral dissertation, which I'm amazed to say was back in the late 1980s.
With the lovely and wonderful...
With the wonderful Lisa Jardine, yep, exactly, in Cambridge. And the figure's name was John Dee, D-E-E, and he is often thought of as the kind of Merlin figure at the court of Queen Elizabeth I. So very heavily associated with magic, with alchemy, all kinds of prognostication, but also, crucially, the creator of the biggest library in Renaissance England. And what I tried to do is focus on what that library empowered or enabled him to do and to open it up really as a different kind of institution and thinking about what a kind of cutting-edge, universal, magically inflected library would allow an individual who owned it to do. And so I called it a kind of think tank, but that was not necessarily the best choice. It could be a laboratory, it could be an alchemical site, could be a magical site. And so,
or even though just a place of curiosity.
Curiosity, exactly.
And just to segue into that, what does curiosity mean for you? And I think there's no right answer here.
Yeah, well, I often talk about why I'm drawn to what I'm drawn to, why I've given now 30-some years to research and teaching in a university or museum setting. And it is simply the pursuit of things that we don't know. And I actually think that's crucial to return to, because we tend to do them in places, let's call it, you know, a library or a university or an information economy setting, where our tools are very much focused on taking us to, in a way, to what we already know, or to providing methods for us to show that we already know something. And I think I have really found it important to repeat that, and almost as a mantra, that research is based on the pursuit of what we don't know and don't even know we don't know. And I think that's really important. I'll come back to that in relation to the Warburg Institute. But I think the other thing to just say very, very crucially about Dee and about Warburg is that curiosity isn't always a good thing. And I think it's important to look at the history of concepts and the history of words. And if we were having this conversation in 1600 rather than 2020, if you had asked me about curiosity, I would almost certainly have a negative answer, because it's risky, it's dangerous, it's in some ways looking at what you weren't supposed to look at. And I think with Dee, he was really pushing the envelope and paid the price in some ways, because he was very avant-garde. He was very much on the edge of things.
And he went too far, some would say.
And some would say he went too far. Yeah. And so I think that's really crucial to bear in mind, is that curiosity now is almost entirely seen as a good thing. But in the Renaissance period, it was almost entirely a negative thing.
I am interested in coming back to the how of how we explore curiosity and being curious. But I think that really has a lot to do with your story about what the Warburg Institute is, and in particular, Arbi Warburg's place in that. And I'd love you to tell that story about the Institute, and then also him and his approach. And we can go into that a little bit more, but I think the how is kind of built into that story.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe the best place to start is with the library that I am actually sitting within as we speak. The library of A.B. Warburg starts as a personal collection of books. It's a private library. It's funded by capital. It's the result of his family having become one of the great banking families in Germany. He becomes very curious about learning and about books in particular. And so at the age of 13, this is the story, and I think it's true for once, he says to his younger brother, Max — he's the oldest of five brothers — and he says, "Max, I know I'm the eldest son, and I've inherited the birthright to the great family bank, but actually I'm not interested in books. I'm interested in scholarship, and in particular in art history. And so I will give you the family birthright. You can become the great leader of the bank if you buy me any book I ever ask for."
Amazing.
So when they're kids, they make this deal and they stick to it for their whole life. And A.B. then carries on as a scholar and creates one of the great private libraries in Central Europe. He does so partly by studying in Italy. He spends a lot of time both as a student and then as an amateur scholar in Italy. And then he becomes a kind of, again, a bit like Dee. It's hard to say what he is. I mean, we don't have categories or words for this, but he creates a kind of research institute on the edge of the established structures, civic structures, university structures. And he does so in Hamburg, in his native town. And in fact, he does so literally on the space that's empty next to his house. So when his house is too small to hold all of his books and all of the activities that he wants to host, he buys the lot next to his house and builds a research library building. And that carries on until the 1920s. In 1929, his brothers endow it and become the trustees. But that same year, A.B. himself dies. And then 4 years later, in 1933, the Nazis come to power. The entire thing is evacuated. And after some discussion, it is sent over to London. So from 1933 to the present, the Warburg Institute has been in London.
Bill, tell us a little bit more about the library and its structure.
Yeah, sure. So the library created by A.B. Warburg has a very unique classification system. And it's probably the thing he's most famous for today, along with his magnum opus, the Bilder Atlas or Image Atlas. The library structure is unique in that it is structured according to four general categories. So each floor is devoted to one of these four general concepts. And they are image, word, orientation, and action. And within the structure of the library, he doesn't give every book, or didn't give every book, its own class mark. He only puts it in a particular section, which is almost organically connected to a network of other subjects. And so the basic approach to it is that it takes you to a section where you then explore, where you browse, where you find unexpected resources that are related to what you thought you were looking for. And that is because, and he's very famous for this phrase, that his library was built around the principle or the law of the good neighbor. And what he meant was, or what he often glossed that as saying, is that the book next to the one you're looking for is usually the one that you need.
Was this unusual?
It's very unusual. I mean, as of course we have Dewey Decimal System, we have lots of classification systems that guide the construction of libraries. And they are, as our library catalogs today, or indeed Google or something like that, they're basically designed for you to enter what you're searching for and for you to be taken more or less directly to that thing. What Warburg wanted was for you to not be taken directly to that thing, for you to have to find it in a context of other things. And I think that's what makes the library the kind of magical engine that it is today.
And stimulating the curiosity of the explorer.
Indeed, a curiosity that you didn't even know you had. It forces you to look for things that are beyond what you know already.
And find things. I mean, the law of the good neighbor is such a brilliant idea that you're
right.
Looking for something and you find something that you think you were looking for, but actually the thing that you that has the information is in the context around it and you might find it on the shelves.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag Curious Advantage and join the conversation.
There are some other things that A.B. Warburg also invented in terms of his, you mentioned his visual library.
Yes, exactly. So alongside the library of books, he also creates what we now call the photo collection. But in German, library is Bibliothek, and in German, photo collection is Fototek. It's a photo library, and it's an image archive that is also classified according to a unique system of classification. And in this case, it's what we call iconographic. So it basically takes you to subjects of meaning. So instead of taking you to Titian and to a specific painting by Titian, it will take you to the god or goddess represented, or even the concept embodied in a particular image.
It sounds like in a modern day instance, Instagram.
Yeah.
These other digital visual libraries are echoes of...
It is, although Instagram is I suppose it uses a much more individual... It's based on individual patterns, and it's also a very limited range in general of tags. I mean, all of our visual classification systems in the digital age tend to use a very, very limited range of tags. We have over 20,000 categories in our photo collection.
So I could find an image in the visual library.
Yeah.
For example, you mentioned Titian or
right.
a painting by Titian, but the tags that are connected to that image will have meaning.
Right.
And will take me to the meanings that could be related to that image.
Right, exactly. And then it takes you back into the library where you can read the history of that image or the history of that concept.
I have to ask this. Is it like a proto-internet? Is it a kind of pre-internet internet-type place.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes say that A.B. Varburg was digital before there was digital. Another way to look at it, I mean, I don't know if you know another contemporary, slightly younger contemporary of Warburg is Walter Benjamin or Walter Benjamin.
Yeah.
And Benjamin's got this great essay that everybody likes to quote, but very few people read, which is about the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. And that essay has an incredibly interesting section where he says that some people seem to call forth a technology that doesn't yet exist. They seem to need a tool or even a medium that doesn't yet exist. And so for
they have to invent it.
Yeah. So Shakespeare, in some ways, invents film, the moving image. It's just an interesting and provocative way of putting it. But
you have to tell us more about that.
Yeah, tell us a little more. What do you mean by that Shakespeare invented the moving image?
Well, the sort of the kinds of sequential narrative, the kinds of jumps, that the cuts, the kinds of things that as a technology cinema allows don't yet exist in the Renaissance, where you're really talking about words on paper and people moving around on stage. You've really got a set of kind of narrative and visual or dramaturgical techniques that we actually associate with much, much later periods and much, much later technologies. Similarly, A.B. Varburg is making jumps, nonlinear moves, associations that we associate particularly with collage or with a kind of mood board thinking. He works visually in an associative way and in a nonlinear way that's very unusual, even for his own time. And so now it's all over the place because our digital tools have grown up around facilitating those things. But at the time when Warburg is doing these atlas techniques, which he's a real pioneer, he's not inventing the idea of a visual assemblage or a visual collection. Those exist, you know, as long as there are images and things to put them on. But there's a kind of thinking that I think he does really pioneer. And what, again, just as his library takes you through multiple subjects, I think his mode of thinking or his mode of doing history, of thinking in time, it really brings together different fields that in some cases are very well established and in others are really new and really risky.
Yeah, you mentioned iconographic so on, which is a pretty new so discipline.
Yeah, and in fact, his own PhD dissertation on Botticelli and on its classical sources, on the way Botticelli's paintings are using Ovid is really what he's focusing on.
Yeah,
that really is seen as inventing that field of iconography. On the other hand, he's constantly drawing on very established terms or methods from anthropology, from geography, even from proper science. And so he's bringing those together in a really unusual and fresh and sometimes baffling, but always curious.
I'm fascinated about what you talk about, this technology and the invention of technology by a need. And also, you know, I agree with you, the use of the word technology is not necessarily about mechanical technology at all. It's about a system of thought or a system of things that are connected in a way of looking at something, which is as distinct from anything else and leads to completely new ways of understanding things. You've mentioned the visual library. One of the other things he invented was something called the Mnemosyne Atlas.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So A.B. Varburg really from about 1900, maybe 1905, is already teaching or communicating through the form of a selection of images, sometimes on a board, sometimes on a page, sometimes using slides in the kind of classic art history technology. He is also developing a habit of these panels, very large scale. They're more than a meter tall. In some cases, they're almost 2 meters tall, covered with a fabric onto which he puts all kinds of miscellaneous material, visual material. And in some cases, that is the actual form of communication or argument. And in the final years of his life, from 1926, certainly to his death in 1929, he is obsessed with creating what he calls an atlas. It is a map, but it's a very unusual map. It's a map of expressive gestures. It's physical gestures. It's ideational or conceptual gestures. It's sometimes mythological story gestures. We might call them moves. Moves is maybe in colloquial language a better way to put it. So it's a visual map through time and space of these move types or gesture types that actually structure and preserve memory. That's what he is trying to map.
It is amazing. We know so much more now from neuroscience and neural behavior,
right,
about how memory is laid down, not only through the use of hormones and neurotransmitters, but also the way that images and connections are made in the brain are much more febrile and much more networky, and how we, in some respects, he is mimicking, I think, what is going on in our brain at some level. The collages, the moods, the general links between things, which are very fuzzy in some respects, all lead up to an impression of something which is more profound.
That's
and
right.
He's doing that without words, and he's doing that using the dialogue between imagery, I think.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
I'm interested in what does this mean for us in the age of the internet? What is the role of the Warburg, and what is the role of these processes or these ways of looking at information? I like to think it's very important because it keeps us looking at information in an open way and not closing too soon, and that can lead into all kinds of dangers.
Yep.
But what is the role of the Warburg Institute in the age of the internet?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I mean, one is that it needs to keep drawing people into a place that holds physical books and physical images. And it needs to keep asking, as we go digital, as our digital tools, technologies become stronger, more pervasive, what is the role of a place that grew out of an analog method, an analog world? And I think that question remains crucial, because it's very easy to lose sight of the ways in which analog tools can be more sophisticated than digital tools. Digital tools tend to be assumed to be more powerful, more pervasive. That's not always true.
No, they can have quite a narrow bandwidth, if you know what I mean.
They can, exactly right.
And the idea of Warburg is to keep the bandwidth as open as possible.
That's right. The second thing is to continue to come to a place that asks questions that you don't, that actually forces you to ask questions that you do not yet know how to ask. And that's the thing that I think the Warburg Institute has to keep doing. It has to do it in a way that embraces the digital, but it also has to take people into the classroom, into the library, into the exhibition space, where you continue to ask these questions that you do not yourself yet know how to ask. It's partly about learning tools that you don't have, like foreign languages. More than half of the Warburg Institute's library is not in English. And so in order to use it fully, and in order to track the history of classical culture in the modern age, you know, Warburg was absolutely committed to learning these tools, learning languages, learning visual symbols, all of those different kinds of languages.
So Warburg has a role in the age of it. It reminds us, it finds a place where we can find new questions and continues to force us to ask questions. And it continues to, in some respects, inform new ways of looking at information from new perspectives.
Yeah. If I were to just boil it down to three things. One, it forces us to continue to look for questions as much as or rather than answers. It continues to force us to browse as much as to search. And it continues to force us to put things in association with each other rather than in some kind of causal, limited, linear line.
I love it. And, you know, the thing that in our research around curiosity and entering new contexts,
yeah.
if you like,
yeah,
we've discovered at least two different types of situations. One where you will be entering a context that already exists. Perhaps you want to become a doctor or you want to learn to play the piano.
Right.
You start with, you know, entering a body of knowledge that already exists in other people's heads. You have to move into a community, and that information starts to inhabit your mind and yeah. your brain, if you like.
Yeah.
But then the other one is the one about creativity and learning new things and laying down new pathways. And this is about going into areas and making connections where other people may not have done that before.
Yeah.
And we require a safe place to do that. We require some ability to ask those questions or find ourselves in a situation where the questions are being asked of us, you know. And it seems to me that Abhi Warburg's approach gives us a way into that in terms of how to be curious.
It does. I think it's partly because he was very open to... So if you look at his own work, you see two clear examples of that kind of move to curiosity or prompt to curiosity that you're talking about. One is he continually draws on the language and method of other fields. So he's primarily working in art history, but almost all of his language comes from the mechanical, natural, earth, human sciences. So what can we learn by drawing on these adjacent or even opposing disciplines? The second thing he does is move through time. So he'll say, what can you learn about the ancient world by looking at modern advertising? Or vice versa, what can you learn about the Renaissance, Botticelli, by looking at Ovid? So he's continually asking how one period can speak to another period.
We love that idea because we use it in our books quite a lot. The idea of looking at prehistory or great civilizations or cities like Venice and so on, because we love to kind of state the obvious that change is always with us, and there are always things that have been confronted by humanity,
yeah.
and humanity has dealt with it in different ways, and how can we learn from the best of it and move forward and keep that information present in today. So we like to really look at the past as we look at the future at the same time.
Yeah.
As we finish this amazing conversation, Bill, I want to ask you, what do you think all we know about Abhi Warburg and the Warburg Institute and all of their your experience, what does this imply for us as curious individuals?
Well, as I said, we have to keep asking questions. We have to keep being open to the haunting of the past. We have to keep being open to the puzzles posed by people who know other things than us and who speak other kinds of languages than us. And I think that is the definition of curiosity for me, continuing to be open to what we can learn from what we do not know, even from what we do not understand. And I think that's where it all starts.
Bill, from Paul and myself, thank you for a fascinating edition of The Curious Advantage. We look forward to visiting the Warburg Institute soon. Thank you again. Absolutely amazing.
A real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and edited by John McGinty and Jill Damatak-Futter.